Augustine did not shrink, it is clear, however, that this was not the unanimous opinion of the early church, since Gregory of Nazianzum can be quoted in the opposite sense. From the time of the schoolmen onwards, a more reasonable view has prevailed, viz. That original sin is no source of personal guilt, and the unbaptized infant is therefore free from all that pain of sense by which personal guilt is punished. The Jansenist influence endeavored, but ineffectually, to procure a condemnation of this milder view, and it is obvious that the Catechism of the Council of Trent does not attempt a decision of the question when it says that unbaptized infants remain in statu miseriae, a phrase which is perfectly well understood as merely contrasting the natural with the supernatural life. 1. The opinion is now universal amongst Catholics that, although these infants are excluded from that supernatural vision of God, to which our nature does not entitle us, they nevertheless enjoy some kind of natural happiness, and the opinion which stigmatized this doctrine of limbo as a Pelagian fable was condemned by Pius VI as false, rash, and injurious to Catholic teaching. On what principle it is that certain souls are chosen to enjoy through baptism a higher state of felicity without ever becoming capable of a moral choice, he knows who created them, and who can tell what they would have made of their lives had life been granted to them? But, once a man has attained the age of reason, he is bound, Catholic theology teaches, for one of two ultimate destinies, fixed and eternal, hell or heaven, and this is true even of those myriads of souls which have never had the opportunity, or never had full opportunity, to hear the Christian message preached, true of those many souls which have never inherited any intelligent tradition of theism. All of these, in proportion as invincible ignorance debarred them from the truth, will be judged according to the lights they had. It is not difficult to see that such ignorance may extend to the principles of natural morality, or rather to their application. Thus, we hold that suicide is a contravention of the natural law written in men's hearts. But, where an Indian widow commits suicide in accordance with an immemorial fashion, or where an Otho prefers his own death to the ruin of his country, is it not natural to assume that, although their consciences were misinformed, they acted according to the highest lights they had? Theologians may disagree as to the manner in which such unbaptized souls achieve the baptism of desire, whether the fact that they would have sought baptism if they had known about it is sufficient to justify them, or whether some special revelation must be postulated to account for their salvation. But the fact remains clear: nobody goes to hell except through his own fault, and those who are the beneficiaries of this principle must therefore attain heaven, by whatever means, and upon whatever title. These considerations clearly do not apply to those who, having once obtained the grace of faith through baptism, and arrived at an intelligent appreciation of Christian tenets, abandon their belief in favor of agnosticism, or of some rival religion. That failure of the mental powers can be held to excuse such a change of sentiments is evident from the controversy which arose over the later speculations of Mivart, and the ecclesiastical sanction which ultimately granted him Christian burial. It may well be that some of those whom we regard as formal apostates were not responsible for their apparently sane decisions. It may well be that others never really left the faith, because in fact, through defect of education, the faith had never been in them. It is difficult not to believe that the absence of all priestly ministrations sometimes causes, especially among the uneducated, inculpable lapses from Christian unity. But such charitable speculations will not always be in place, and there are careers upon which no optimistic epitaph can be pronounced, except the hope that some change of heart, outwardly unattested, may have saved the unhappy soul from the guilt of final impenitence. But, whereas it is normal to assume that one who takes the initiative in heresy will be held responsible for his disloyalty to Catholic doctrine, it would be unreasonable to argue that one born and bred in heresy, who does not see his way to accepting the Catholic faith, lies under the same condemnation. All the traditions of his thought, all the prejudices of his race and caste, all the influence of his friends and teachers, has been thrown into the opposite scale. The visitor tells not for, but against his chances of being a Catholic. Meanwhile, he has probably received valid baptism, the habit of faith, then, has been implanted in him, and those circumstances of environment and education which have made him a heretic are not imputable to him, as a fault, he has not willfully sinned against it. So long, therefore, as he does not come in contact with the Catholic system at all, or does not come across it in such a way as to be effectively challenged by its claims, he has not refused grace. So long as he takes all reasonable pains to study those claims in a fair-minded spirit, and still, through some defect of outlook, of temperament, of intellectual apparatus, finds himself drawn no nearer to the truth, he has not refused grace. His ignorances, so far as we can tell, of the invincible kind, he remains what he is, in good faith. If he falls into grave sin, he has, of course, no access to sacramental absolution, but it is still possible for him to make that perfect act of contrition which claims forgiveness. We have no fears for such heretics as this. But, we must repeat, it is not through adhesion to any other religious body that such a man can qualify for membership in our church, as by a kind of adundum degree. Rather, he is a lonely satellite of the church's system that has lost its true orbit. And it should be added that this plea of good faith is one which may be urged on behalf of the Protestant, but it is not one which he can urge in his own behalf. A man can say, "You are in good faith," "He is in good faith," but not, "I am in good faith." That is to beg the question. The attitude of mind painfully common which says, "I am not qualified to go into all these complicated credentials of the Catholic Church," is an attitude of intellectual indolence masquerading as intellectual humility. The man who thinks there may be something in it, yet makes no effort to find out how much, is actuated not by invincible, but by supine ignorance. The man who, worse still, excuses himself from examining our credentials for fear lest he should find them to be true, who tells you that he is too busy to consider the Catholic claim, or too modest, or too unadventurous, when at the back of his mind he is shrinking from the injury to his prospects, the troubles with his family which submission to the church would involve, such a man is actuated not by invincible, but by affected ignorance. And, I am sorry to say it, I believe there is much supine ignorance, much affected ignorance, among our fellow countrymen. Let them not deceive themselves, they will have to find another title to heaven, if they are to attain heaven at all. I must add a word here, lest I should be accused of burking the subject, about the attitude which the church holds on the subject of coercion in spiritual matters. There is no space here to reason with those whose fancies are obsessed with the horrors of the Inquisition, to such an extent that they cannot speak calmly of it. But those who are more skilled in analyzing their own antipathies may be invited to consider the following distinctions. The employment of torture by the Inquisition was in accordance with the judicial practice of the time, as Protestant England can witness. It is utterly out of accord with the spirit of our own age, and a Catholic authority would be no more likely to inflict it now than a Protestant authority. The death penalty, which 150 years ago was still inflicted for such crimes as horse stealing, has similarly passed out of vogue except in dealing with brutalized characters, and I see no reason to think that it would ever be re-enacted for religious offenses, however much Catholicism should gain ground in the councils of nations. So far as atrocities are concerned, Catholics may well be thankful that we have got rid of them, though we shall beg leave to insist that Catholic tribunals had no monopoly of such proceedings. But a more intimate doubt assails the liberal temperament. Is it just, since thought is free, to penalize in any way differences of speculative outlook? Ought not every church, however powerful, to act as a body corporate within the state, exercising no form of coercion except that of exclusion from its own spiritual privileges? It is very plain that this has not been the Catholic theory in times past. There has been, in Catholic nations, a definite alliance between the secular and the spiritual power. So, to be sure, has there been among Protestant nations. But may it be understood that in our enlightened age Catholics would repudiate the notion of any such alliance in future. It must be freely admitted that this is not so. You cannot bind over the Catholic Church as the price of your adhesion to her doctrines to waive all right of invoking the secular arm in defense of her own principles. The circumstances in which such a possibility could be realized are indeed sufficiently remote. You have to assume, for practical purposes, a country with a very strong Catholic majority, the overwhelming body of the nation. Probably, though not certainly, you would have to assume that the non-Catholic minority are innovators, newly in revolt against the Catholic system, with no ancestral traditions, no vested interests to be respected. Given such circumstances, is it certain that the Catholic government of the nation would have no right to insist on the Catholic religion being taught in all schools open to the general public, and even to deport or imprison those who unsettled the minds of its subjects with new doctrines? It is certain that the Church would claim that right for the Catholic government, even if considerations of prudence forbade its exercise. In fact, the Catholic Church will not be one amongst the philosophies. Her children believe, not that her doctrines may be true, but that they are true, and consequently part of the normal makeup of a man's mind. Not even a parent can legitimately refuse such education to his child. They recognize, however, that such truths, unlike the mathematical axioms, can be argued against, that simple minds can easily be seduced by the sophistries of plausible error. They recognize, further, that the divorce between speculative belief and practical conduct is a divorce in thought, not in fact, that the unchecked developments of false theories result in ethical aberrations. Anabaptism yesterday, Bolshevism today, which are a menace even to the social order. Such considerations would reasonably be invoked if a body of Catholic patriots, entrusted with the government of a Catholic state, should deny to the innovator the right of spreading his doctrines publicly, and so endangering the domination of Catholic principles among their fellow countrymen. It is frequently argued that if Catholics have at the back of their system such notions of toleration, it is unreasonable in them to complain when a modern state restricts, in its turn, the political or educational liberty which they themselves wish to enjoy. What is sauce for the goose is sauce, surely, for the gander. The contention is ill-conceived, for, when we demand liberty in the modern state, we are appealing to its own principles, not to ours. The theory of the modern state is that all religions should be equally tolerated, as long as they do not disturb the peace, or otherwise infringe the secular laws of the country. We only claim to share that right amongst the rest. The philosophic basis on which the modern state rests its theory is that truth is great, and will prevail. A false system of religion will condemn itself in the end by its own unreasonableness, without external interference. Does it fear, then, our religion, more than others? And if so, on what grounds, unless it be on the somewhat paradoxical ground that our religion is true? If the Church is persecuted by men with strong religious convictions, she offers the dumb protest of martyrdom. It is when she is persecuted by men who loudly proclaim they have none, that she ventures to tax them with inconsistency. In a word, the unity of the Church has hard edges. Of this our Protestant ancestors did not complain. They had their hard edges too. Our generation, suckled on the milk of 19th century liberalism, still hankers after cloudy formulas and indefinite compromise. But is this mood of vagueness permanent? In an era which has produced Bolshevism and Fascism, it seems a pardonable doubt. End notes. 1. Miseria is the scholastic opposite of Felicitas, Soma 2/2. 30. And the felicity here in question is the supernatural felicity which consists in the vision of God. 19. Catholicism and the future. If the Church is criticized in religious circles for her indifference to the reunion movement, she disappoints the more secular-minded once more by an attitude of negation, wrapped up in her own ambitions for recovering the lost allegiance of humanity. She appears to view all schemes for the social betterment of mankind at best with tolerance, and commonly with suspicion. We have inherited from the Victorian age the dogma of human progress. No age can live without an inspiration. When religious inspiration disappears, as it has very largely disappeared from the modern world, man's capacity for self-sacrificing devotion to a cause must find its outlet in other channels, here and there. If political grievances or other accidents of history have sharpened the edge of nationality, a people can find its inspiration in purely patriotic movements. Elsewhere, no enthusiasm is left to us except an enthusiasm for humanity at large, and this is not easily kindled by a contemplation of the human species, as it now is. Those restless spirits, therefore, which cannot be happy unless they are working for an ideal, must pin their faith to a regenerate world of tomorrow. When mechanical invention has made life still easier for us, and medicine has made it still more comfortable for us, when selective breeding has eliminated from our ranks those who are C3 men in the battle of life, when education has made us more fit to occupy our leisure upon worthy objects, more responsive to the thrill of noble ideals, when a redistribution of wealth at home, and a new sense of world solidarity, have put an end to our antagonisms, then we shall have produced a race worth fighting for and worth working for. Then we shall have established, with no help from supernature, a kingdom of heaven on earth. It is a matter of observation that Catholics do not commonly echo this sonorous phraseology of our time. Does that mean that the Catholic system is itself incompatible with such hopes of improvement, or merely that Catholics are too much preoccupied with other considerations to spare any time for these? It would be easy to construct a mere debating reply to the criticism. It might be pointed out that in countries, like ours, where Catholics are a minority of the population, their first concern, the first demand on their time and attention, is to consolidate the position of their own church, or, again, that the hostile attitude shown by the progressive parties in several continental countries has forced the church into a distrust of all such developments. Or what is nearer the truth, it might be said that the church is primarily concerned with the individual soul as a single unit, and that the most striking and most characteristic of the activities set on foot by her children are out of harmony with the spirit of the time precisely because they take the individual soul, here and now, as their point of departure, instead of being concerned with the fortunes of a class, or of mankind in general. How much of Catholic charity is wasted from the world's point of view, upon the lepers, the incurable, the dying races, too, and the sinful souls, that will never make good. But there is, if we will but have the patience to analyze the situation, and the honesty to admit it, a real difference of view in this whole matter between the Church and the moderns. The moderns believe, the Church does not believe, in the perfectibility of the human character on a large scale. That is the long and short of it. To the moderns, the notion of a continual improvement in the human race is both an axiom of thought and a dogma of faith. An axiom of thought, for if you question it, they suspect you of joking. A dogma of faith, for it is what they live by. The glaring tragedy of life would be too much for them if they had no outlook beyond the present and its indefinite continuance. It is a moral which they deduce, with some hesitations of method, from the developments of history. It is a corollary which they infer, with no very good title, from the scientific hypothesis of evolution. Economic history, even, is subpoenaed to prove the case. Capitalism itself is treated as a stage in the development towards higher things. The expression of such confidence in the future is out of date, Victorian, but the confidence itself is nonetheless deep in men's hearts, because unuttered. I sometimes fancy that even if the Catholic Church had no doctrine bearing on the point, she would still smile, in the wisdom she has garnered from experience, at the pathetic optimism of our modern visionaries. Who has not known some old, perfectly mellowed schoolmaster, trained by long experience, to adopt a double attitude towards youth, infinite patience with the individual, and a profound distrust of the type? So many short-lived generations have passed through his hands, and he has watched them make the same mistakes, cultivate the same poses, suffer from the same conviction of their own originality. No. The type does not alter. It is for him to do the best he can with the material that is given him, and the Catholic Church since the day when she was sent to teach all nations, is much in the schoolmaster's position. There is no trend of philosophy, no movement in politics, no nation, even in Europe, which does not seem young to her, and should she not be tempted to doubt, even on experimental grounds, the perfectibility of the human character? She has seen that magnificent creature of man, the Roman Empire, grow to its full strength, and then crumble into a dust heap of nationalities. She has watched chieftaincy grow into kingship, and kingship fade into constitutional monarchy. She has witnessed the epic tragedy of the Crusades. She has seen the rise and the decadence of Bible Protestantism, and Ridley's candle guttering in its socket. She has seen the French Revolution spring up, and blossom into a tyranny, slavery die, and industrialism replace it, aristocracy fail, and plutocracy rise on its ruins. She has stood by, while three great empires vanished in 2 years, while men beat their swords into plowshares, and thence melted their plowshares into high explosive. Commercial world hegemony has passed from Spain to France, from France to England, from England to the United States, and, to her longer memory, every experiment seems by the fashion of a time, every rebirth of ours abortive. We do not repeat the same mistakes precisely. Here and there the failure of our ancestors has blazed the trail for us, but is the world really reaching a promised land? Or is it wandering, like Israel, 40 years in the wilderness? The hesitation, I say, might be pardoned in her, even if no revealed doctrine lend credence to it. But theology tells her that man is a fallen creature, and, were she tempted to be 1,000 times more optimistic over his future, she would still despair of his perfectibility on this side of the grave. Here and there, she tells us, a soul full of heroic sanctity will spring up in our midst, like a sport of nature. Now and again the impetus of some great movement will stampede a whole multitude of souls into unwonted generosity of purpose. But in the long run Adam's taint will be forever breaking out in his posterity. New efforts will be needed to reclaim humanity, new ideals to inspire it. It is the settled mood of pessimism, almost of cynicism, in her that scandalizes the ardent temperament of our world reformers. She will not believe, with them, that our race can ever be endowed, through human means, with indefectible virtue. She lets us build our sandcastles, but depresses us with the reminder that the tide will carry them away. The Church's attitude, then, is dogmatic, but here it is no more dogmatic than the attitude of her opponents. Where, after all, can we find any proof that the human type is perfecting? Any notion, even, whither the history of its process is developing? There is a modern tendency. Mr. Wells, in his Outline of History, is its exponent, to dwarf the whole pedigree of our civilization, to shorten the whole perspective of events, by pointing us back to the long ages which elapsed before history itself began those successive periods which the geologists find it necessary to postulate in coordinating their hitherto achieved results. No wonder these authors suggest that you cannot find any real development in the human type between Babylon yesterday and Washington today. That is because you have chosen too short a section of the process to recognize the past from which we came and forecast the future which lies before us. You must contrast the humanity of today not with that of the cuneiform inscriptions, but with that which left us our earliest cave drawings. Can we pretend that the human species has not advanced in culture since it lived the grimy, brutish existence of Halbert and Hobbes? But the process is obscurum proscurius. We know something about the minds of the men who have left us organized writing. We know nothing of the men who have left us, boy-like, a picture or two on the walls. Not even whether it was men or boys that drew them. They could draw men and women about as well as I can. Animals very much better than I can. That is a boy's trick. But I do not know whether the human figures were portraits of friends or caricatures of enemies or images of gods. I do not know whether the bones of their friends were painted red out of some funeral piety, or whether the bones of their enemies were painted red in savage triumph. You cannot accept the bushman as a representative of primitive culture, until you can be certain that he has not degenerated, like the Aztecs. In short, if you want to base your dogma of human progress upon facts, they must be the facts which are yielded by historical, not by merely archaeological records. Still less will you derive any support from going back behind the human species altogether and attempting to link up the progress of mankind with the theory of biological evolution. Biology knows of nothing except survival values. The qualities which it holds up for our admiration are qualities which enable the species to avoid destruction, whether by means of superior attack or of superior defense. But the moral values which mankind has agreed to revere are not those which tend to preserve the species. The charity which provides for the sick in hospitals, for the lunatics in asylums, is cumbering the earth with useless wheat, with unproductive consumers, and that at a time when the wiseacres tell us our common food supply will barely suffice our growing needs for another century. Evolution clamors that these inferior specimens of the race should be eliminated. Morality revolts from the doctrine. It is not because of nature, but in spite of nature, that philanthropy has come to embarrass us. What, then, are the facts which emerge from an unbiased study of history about the progress of man? It is certain that, by a merely mechanical law, the comfort of his surroundings increases. The useful arts, once discovered, are not suffered to die out. We can avoid pain. We can annihilate distance. We can produce the means of gratification more readily than our ancestors could. Probably we are becoming, in a corresponding measure, softer than they. Habituation to comforts has reduced, though with incuriously defined limits, the hardiness of our physique. No doubt, again, but man has become a more complicated creature in a thousand ways. His aesthetic appreciations are subtler. His intellect more active, his outlook more individualized, even his appreciation of moral issues more acute. But does man obey, with more and more facility, as the centuries roll by, those interior monitions of conscience which claim to wield an influence over his behavior? It is certainly true that institutions have disappeared from the greater part of the world, it would seem permanently, whose disappearance every Christian must welcome. Whether the non-Christian welcomes it equally depends upon his point of view. Formal slavery has disappeared, and physical torture used for judicial purposes, and the exposure of children, and the amphitheater, and the duel, and child labor, and the grosser forms of purposeless cruelty towards animals. But these are not vices personal to the individual, they are vicious systems, against which the conscience of individuals long protested. Before the community took any steps, the progressive enlightenment of the public conscience is fortunately a fact, though it is not certain what guarantee we have against retrogression. But the fact that the public obeys its own conscience is due, if we will be honest with ourselves, very largely to the policeman. The really salient fact about the modern age, from the Wars of the Roses onwards, is the growing effectiveness of centralized government. Ultimately traceable to the influence of explosives. Not only have we better laws, but our laws are better kept. Where morality involves justice towards your neighbor, there is less temptation to do wrong now than formerly. Indeed, there is every temptation to do right. But does all this mean that, given the free opportunity, the average man today resists his temptations, such as they are, better than he did in the Dark Ages? There is, as far as I am aware, no theological reason why this should not be so, why there should not, I mean, be a certain moral improvement, as time goes on, in the general level of mankind. Theology only assures us that we cannot breed out altogether that concupiscence which the fall has left behind it. But as a matter of fact, there seems to be little ground for assuming that any such improvement has taken place. It is easy to say, for example, that drunkenness is less common now than it used to be. But does that really mean that our generation is more self-disciplined than its predecessors? When you reflect on the various influences, that have checked drunkenness the deterrent efforts of the law, the decline in robustness of physique, the artificial inflation of prices, the change of manners which operates on our instincts of social cowardice, and so on. It is hard to be impressed by the statistics. Circumstances restrict our opportunities for self-indulgence, and a modern squeamishness of taste moderates its grosser forms, but this is not a change of heart. Let it be said at once that no Christian and no Catholic can fail to rejoice when he finds the temptations to wrongdoing diminished by legal or social coercion, so long as men's common liberties are respected. No body of men in the country has, I suppose, more cogent reason to deplore the bad conditions under which poor families live and the Catholic clergy. Grinding poverty is a well-known enemy not only to morals, but to faith itself. But always our primary preoccupation is to help men make the best of the conditions in which they find themselves, whereas the primary preoccupation of the modern reformer is to better the conditions, and to hope for a new race of men. Our work is to colonize heaven, theirs to breed for utopia, and that disparity of inspiration leads, again and again, to a contrast of method. The revolutionary reformer wishes to achieve utopia by methods which offend against our sense of justice. The bureaucratic reformer wishes to achieve utopia by methods which offend against our sense of liberty. Neither side finds in us an ally who can be trusted to go all lengths. Either side, therefore, distrusts our alliance, and at best tolerates it, as necessary embarrassment. It seems probable enough that the Armageddon of the future lies between Catholicism and some form of humanitarianism. I mean the attempt in some form to produce a perfect humanity through the external pressure of breeding, education, and legal coercion. Some writers have, perhaps, made this forecast with undue confidence. History has not yet forgotten how to cheat the prophets, but our modern symptoms do, it must be admitted, point that way. More and more, it appears, men's loyalties fluctuate between the extremes of supernaturalism and materialism. The less definite Christianities are molds in which they settle but do not harden. If these attract, they attract precisely where they are content to approximate to either extreme by wearing with a difference the world's colors or ours. It is not safe to prophesy the disappearance of any religious body. It is their way to linger on, skeleton armies, long after their effectiveness has spent itself. But the tendency of modern religion is away from moderate counsels. It is admitted even by many who deplore it. Already we Catholics are embarrassed by unwelcome admirers on the continent, by authoritarians who reject the supernatural in England, by sacramentalists who reject authority. It will not be wonderful if the second generation from ours finds clearer issues presented to it in the world's debate. Meanwhile, the ethos of Catholics is not futuristic. They live not on dreams, but on convictions. They witness without surprise the depopulation of religion around them. We have been told beforehand that the days will come when charity shall wax cold. Yet they do not, like some Protestant enthusiasts, look round them eagerly for the signs of an approaching world dissolution. They have heard the cry of wolf too often. They devote themselves, rather, to the business of their own souls, and to influencing, in whatever modest way may be practicable, the lives of those around them, secure of inviolable principles, and of a hope which cannot fade. He that believeth, let him not make haste. It is commonly among Catholics themselves, where faith is weakest, that clamor is loudest for a policy and a world attitude. But you, beloved, building yourselves upon your most holy faith, praying in the Holy Ghost, keep yourselves in the love of God, waiting for the mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ unto life everlasting.